I put the page number there leading into the Gospel of Luke. So I'm hoping that the Holy Spirit will make use of that. And so pardon me if I seem to be fiddling with my phone for that. Just by way of introduction, probably the most important thing you should know about me is that I'm an undeservedly adopted son of God my son. And I want to emphasize undeserved, because I am a rebel who committed high treason against the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He not only offered testing of their relational separation. That's what really hurts. So when we're asking, is there a life after death? I've never seen anybody who asked, you know, who wanted to be just alive forever and ever. But at the end of the day, if I start digging into it just a little bit more, it's almost always about their relationship after death. Am I going to see my father again? Am I going to see, you know, my grandmother ever again? And at some point, you know, sometimes I this is something that everybody can take to the bank. I don't know of a single historian, unless they're part of that really French movement that says Jesus was not even a historical figure. By the way, that's like really strange. I don't know of anybody who teaches at an accredited university who actually holds that view, whether they're atheists or not. Everybody agrees that Jesus died by crucifixion. What else you might say about Jesus? Jesus died by crucifixion on the Pontius Pilate in the year 30 or 33 AD. And one of the criteria that they use is called multiple attestation. So if they find a historical detail in not just one source, but in multiple sources, they take that to be, okay, this is probably more authentic than mine. Right? So we see this in the gospel, in all the gospels, we see this in the letters of Paul, and we see this in documents outside of the Bible even. So everybody's like, oh yeah, we can take this one. The next one, Jesus was buried by a member of the Jewish council, Joseph of Arimathea. There is a criterion called the criterion of embarrassment. And what historians say is, if there is a detail that would have been embarrassing to the early church, then this piece of data is probably more authentic than mine. Right? Now, what is embarrassing about Joseph of Arimathea? He was part of the what? The Jewish council, the Sanhedrin. In the eyes of the early church, these are the guys that committed deicide. They are the ones who engineered the death of the Son of God. So then to have a member of that group come and give Jesus the honorable burial would have been rather embarrassing. Now, we do read in the Gospel accounts that Joseph of Arimathea was secretly a disciple of Jesus. But it's as though the early church felt the need to actually smooth it out. Okay, we know this is a member of the Jewish council, but he was secretly a disciple of Jesus. Okay? So this one, again, multiply attested, we take this one to the bank. On the following Sunday, a group of Jesus' women followers found the tomb empty. Again, this passes the criterion of embarrassment, because who discovered the tomb empty? Jesus' women followers. Because back in those days, sorry ladies, nothing against you personally, back in those days, women's testimony was not considered valid in the court of law. Right? So if you want to, so imagine this, right? Let's say you are part of the early church and you're compiling the stories and traditions about Jesus, and you want to completely fabricate this, that the tomb was empty. If you're completely fabricating this, why would you put women as a discoverer of the tomb? Right? In fact, when we go back to 1 Corinthians 15, which we just read, right, now commentators, the scholars agree that what we just read, especially at the beginning, that Jesus died, that he rose in accordance with the scriptures, those kind of things, and the appearances, that is not mentioned. The women are not mentioned. The scholars agree that this is something of a hymn or something of a creed that had formed pretty early on in the early Jesus community. In fact, there is an apocryphal gospel called the Gospel of Peter, and it's a passage gain by claiming the God raised Jesus from the dead. Because then, like, they're going to get ostracized from the Jewish community. Right? So think about it. You've got to put yourself in the shoes of the early disciples, right? The disciples of Jesus. Your leader is dead. The one that you put all your hope in. Got the punishment of a common criminal. He died a gruesome death, and now what? You were so sure that this was the man who would overthrow Rome and bring liberation to Israel. That didn't happen. What now? So in this case, you have two options. Either you pick the next Messiah, and I am told, I'm not an expert on this, but I am told that the next most probable candidate would have been James, the half-brother of Jesus. Or you go back to your trade, family trade. You go back to fishing and other things, right? But that's not what they did. The disciples suddenly sincerely came to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And they were willing, at least, willing to go to their death for it. And some of them did die, right, claiming that Jesus rose from the dead. So there are these five points of data. Now, there's a second step. You have to actually come up with a theory or a hypothesis that accounts for all these points of data. So what are some hypotheses that are out there, especially for those who have a bit more of a naturalistic bent, like this world is all there is, there's nothing more. Well, there are lots of different ones. One is the conspiracy theory. This is the earliest one. In the early Jewish community, there was this polemic against the gospel, saying, oh, the disciples stole the body, that's why the tomb is empty, and they're lying about it. In fact, commentators on the Gospel of Matthew say that the story of the gospel of the tomb is included in there specifically to answer to the charge that the disciples stole the body. It doesn't mean that it's made up, but it's just saying that this story is specifically included in Matthew. Remember, Matthew was a Jew, right? He was a tax collector, and who is he writing to? Fellow Jews. So he would have been very, very familiar with the charges and the rumors that were going around in the Jewish communities, and he is including the story of the Roman guards at the tomb to answer the charge that the disciples had stolen the body. So that is the earliest one. You still hear about this sometimes just in different variations, because there was some kind of conspiracy on the part of the early disciples. Second one, second hypothesis is the hallucination theory. This is really popular today. The idea is that the disciples really loved Jesus so much that they couldn't handle the death of the master, and so they started hallucinating, and then that got them to mistake and think that Jesus came back from the dead. In the case of Paul, he wasn't a disciple to begin with, but the idea is that in persecuting Christians and handing them over to the executed and all those things, he had a crisis of conscience, and in his guilt, sense of guilt, he hallucinated, and he thought he had encountered Jesus, so on and so forth. So that's the theory. Next one is the swoon theory. This one says Jesus didn't actually die on the cross. He merely fainted, and people thought he was dead, put him in the tomb, and over the weekend, in the coolness of the tomb, he's revived, and he escapes the tomb, and people thought, man, like, he rose from the dead. God raised Jesus from the dead. Finally, you know, it's a real thing. There's a lost twin theory, according to which Jesus had a twin that nobody else knew about, except Mary, probably, right? And after Jesus died, this lost twin came around claiming to be Jesus himself, and everybody was duped. Okay? So then, what we need to do is take a look. Okay, there were the five points of data that I mentioned. The death of Jesus, the burial of Jesus, the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and then the sudden and sincere belief on the part of the disciples. Now what we need to do is take each theory and see if it checks out. So, conspiracy theory. Remember, according to this theory, did Jesus die? Yes. He was buried. Okay? So far, so good. And because the disciples stole the body, the tomb was empty. Okay? But there's a problem. buried. And if the disciples are just hallucinating and the tomb is still occupied, right, that's a problem. Right, doesn't account for the empty tomb. Clearly, they were hallucinating, so they were seeing something, but there's no way they would have sincerely come to believe that Jesus was from the dead. The hallucination is a unimodal thing, and what I mean by that is hallucinations usually involve just one thing. Like maybe there's a sense of sight, maybe hearing, touch, taste, smell, whatever it is. I had a very short hallucination.
You know, I was really heartbroken over a broken romantic relationship.
I swear, out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw that girl walking down the stairs. And then I looked again, and it was somebody totally different. Like, they didn't even look like each other. I was like, oh, well, that's not good. And it lasted very short. I mean, obviously, some hallucinations last longer than that, but it usually involves one thing. But in the case of the disciples, what's happening is, this is happening over the course of 40 days. Remember, Luke wrote two books, the Gospel of Luke, and then he followed up by writing the Book of Acts. And in each of his books, he has this preface, writing to this guy, Theophilus. And so in the Book of Acts, he starts off by saying, hey, Theophilus, in my former volume, by which he means the Gospel according to Luke, I wrote about what Jesus began to do and teach. And he says that Jesus appeared to the disciples over the course of 40 days.
That's a pretty long hallucination.
And it's happening to multiple people in a polymodal way. So remember, Luke was actually talking about how Jesus appeared in the upper room through the locked door. Do you remember that story? He was with you. You know, one of the first questions he asked, do you remember what it was? Y'all got any food? And so he sits down, he's eating, and Luke reports that everybody was staring at him, because they're like, my brain is not braining. What's going on here? Why is he sitting here eating this food? Why is this? They're all looking at this, and they were afraid to ask. Right? And Jesus goes, kind of ghost do that? Referring to him eating and drinking, right? And so what Luke is doing is he's going out of his way to tell his readers that something happened here. Jesus was there. And it's not just sight, it's not just it's sight and hearing, you can smell him, you can just sit there eating. John reports something similar where he goes to see a Galilee, right? The disciples recognize him and they come on to the shore. What is he doing? What is he doing? He's making breakfast. Yeah, he's making breakfast, right? I just love how normal, how human Jesus is in these stories. He's eating and drinking. And hey, come have breakfast. That's what's happening. So I don't think that hallucination, if this was just hallucination, they would have gone so far as to believe that God raised Jesus from the dead. It would have been short-lived, it would have been unimodal, and it doesn't fit the historical data that we have. Next one, Sloan theory says Jesus never died. So right from the get-go, this is not working out. This is not looking very good. He was buried. Right? Remember, according to this theory, he was fainted, right? And he's buried, and he escaped the tomb. Now, I don't know what it is about the coolness of the tomb that revives a half-dead man, right? But anyway, so he's referring to people. There's no way they would have believed this. And they would have justified it in a very different way. Let me slow down here and actually broaden the process of the crucifixion. And it's going to be a little bit gruesome. We have some little ears here too, but just stick with me, and there's a reason I'm doing this. So, death. So first, Jesus gets flogged. Now, we don't know exactly what kind of whip was used. Some people say it was a cat of nine tails, in which case, it's a grasping tool, right?
And it just tears the flesh away.
Or take it something else. But either way, he lost a lot of blood already. Okay, now, they also put on that crown of thorns. And I used to think like crown of thorns, like you're going to be like rose bushes or something like that. I actually had a chance to go to Israel and travel and they have replicas. This is like pretty solid wood with thorns that are like this long, right? So he has that on his head, right? horizontal beam of the cross and the vertical beam that had been already set up on the execution side. So he's carrying this. So I know in tradition we see Jesus carrying the whole cross, but historically, likely he would have carried this really big, heavy beam, right? Jesus doesn't do it on his own, so the soldiers actually have to grab somebody else and say, "You carry it." They take him to the execution site, they lay him out on the cross beam, and you know what they have to do is they have to actually grab the arm, pull it, dislocate his shoulders, and they're putting the nail not just through the hand, because if that's the case, then the weight of the body rips everything, so they put it through the wrist. Now, you know the funny bone nerve there? The same nerve runs all the way through. So if you have a nail going through your wrist, it's like you're grabbing a pair of pliers, grab the nerves, and twist it, right? And he's got both of these. And he's got nails going through his feet. His shoulder dislocated. That's why it's the perspiration is set by asphyxiation. Because when you're hanging like this, you can't really breathe in very well. So you have to push yourself up, breathe in, out, up, in, out. Sometimes this went on for days, right? And all this time, his back is scratched against the rough wood of the cross. So if that's what he is doing, and now, mind you, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and out of reverence for our Savior, we like to, you know, on the crucifix, we like to put a little one cloth there. He wouldn't have had that. He would have had no control of his bladder or bowel. It was just humiliating death. That's what the Romans wanted to do. This was a public execution. They were saying, you mess with us, that's what happens to you. So he's doing this to breathe. Remember, his shoulders are dislocated. Now, if they wanted to expedite the process, what do they do? Break the legs, because then they can't push themselves up. I'm not a medical expert, but I am told that when you die like that, there's this medical phenomenon called pleural effusion, where there's this fluid starting to build around your lungs in your heart. Now, we're told that they broke the legs of the two criminals on either side of Jesus, but when they came to Jesus, he was already dead. So they report to the centurion. The centurion's like, just make sure he's really dead. Mind you, these Roman soldiers are professional killers. They know when somebody's dead, and especially is when it's their head on the line, or if the prisoner escapes, they're going to make sure. So they bring a spear right up in between, right, the ribs, puncturing the lungs and the heart. Now, it's really fascinating. John actually reports that when they pulled out the spear, what's in the mouth? Blood and water. He doesn't just have a pleural effusion, but he seems to have seen something that's authentic. There would have been first water coming out and then blood. There was a lot more blood, so he puts that first, blood and water. Now, why did I tell you all of this? Because I think sometimes, I mean, we say this all the time as Christians, right? Jesus died for my sins. But I think we're perhaps a little too quick about that. When we say Jesus died for our sins, very rarely do we think about the kind of death he suffered for us. He loves you that much. And he was willing to get in, and that is the way of sin that he was carrying. Jesus died for our sins. Hopefully that means something different to you. Anyway, when you actually describe that process, right, it sounds ridiculous that he survived all of that, according to this new theory, he's buried in the tomb. Now, mind you, we're told that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus came, you read that in the Gospel of John, and they bring tens of pounds of perfume, right, and they put it on the body of Jesus and they wrap it in a linen cloth. So we're supposed to believe that he broke through all of that in his condition, like the Incredible Hulk. He goes over, hobbles over to the stone, in this condition, somehow he rolled it away, hobbled over to the upper room, up. Peter opens the door, and Peter, resurrection! There's no way that Peter would have believed in that. In fact, they would have justified it very differently. They would have never said, oh my goodness, don't waste Jesus in the dead. They would
last name is a coming, who is ever fallen. They don't go around saying that Jesus will come today. God raised Jesus from the dead. And so the full theory really fails. The lost twin theory, again, somebody comes along and posturing, right? It's kind of like an among us kind of a situation here. Who's the imposter? According to this theory, Jesus died. He's buried, but again, his body is still in the tomb. It's just an imposter comes along, but the body is still in the tomb. And this is the problem. If the body is still in the tomb, all that the enemies of the early church have to do to defend the church would have been go to the tomb, produce the body of Jesus, and say, go back to fishing. And that would have been the end of Christianity. Now, they would have seen what they believed to be Jesus, but I don't think they would have been convinced. Because, mind you, these disciples spent 3 years or more traveling with Jesus, day in and day out, spent time with him. I am not convinced that there is an imposter in the world who can be so in tune with. Like, what was this lost twin doing? Like, was he following them around from the distance? Because, I mean, the imposter would have to know a lot of inside jokes for one. Hang on a second. What did he just call Thaddeus just now? That's interesting. Why is he laughing at the inside joke? Jesus always laughs at this inside joke. Oh, look. He's not eating the fish he's fried. He loves that fish. Why isn't he eating that? Like, there would have been so many things that the disciples would have picked up on. There's no way whoever imposter comes along could have fooled the disciples who traveled with Jesus for 3 years. So none of these theories accounts for all of historical data, but the resurrection does. Now, I gave you only 5 points of historical data. There's more, right? So conversion of James, that's my actually favorite one. Conversion of James, Jesus' half-brother. Does anybody have a brother here? Anybody have a brother? You have a brother? Brother? Okay, I have an older brother as well, right? Now, let me just ask you this question. If your brother came to you and said, well, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, please, but I'm the Sabbath. I'm the Lord of the universe. I'm the Lord of Sabbath. I am the great God. I can forgive sins. Would you actually believe your brother? What would you tell your brother? You need help. Go get some help. You need to turn yourself into a mental institution, man. I don't know what have you been eating, and where can I get them? I don't know what you've been eating, but something's wrong with you. But James, the half-brother of Jesus, went to his death defending the claim that his own brother is the Lord of God.
That's crazy.
The Messiah that Israel has been waiting for.
Paul was the king
of this church, and somehow he became a follower of Jesus. Now, the day of worship reminds you of the first Christians who were all Jewish, right? And they always met on Saturdays. Sunset Friday to sunset Saturday. That's their Shabbat, their Sabbath. And that's when they gather at the synagogue. But Christians, for whatever reason, also started meeting on Sundays. And when the animosity between the Jews and the Christians started building later, and Christians were kicked out of the synagogue, they started meeting solely on Sunday. So you kind of have to wonder, like, why did the early Christians start meeting on Sunday instead? Another one, the central preaching has always been the resurrection of Jesus. That has always been the message. And the church didn't start in Antioch. The church didn't start in Rome. The church didn't start in Alexandria. The church started in Jerusalem, where these things are supposed to have taken place. Right there. You know, my teacher in school, Dr. Craig Hazen, he has his PhD in religious studies. So he studied lots of different world religions. That is his PhD. And this is one thing he said. If you're going to come up with a new religion, one really bad way to do it is to make it verifiable. Right? If you're going to just completely come up and fabricate a religion, you don't put it on something. just historical reality.